SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Kumi Taguchi and I host a TV show in Australia called Insight, which is unlike any other.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Every week in the same room, we have dozens of guests telling their stories about one shared issue.
There definitely was three people in my marriage.
I started an affair with this man.
From sex and relationships to health, wealth and grief.
Dad, there's been a shooting at the elementary school.
And there's always a guest whose story stays with me.
I actually had guilt for not killing someone.
And I'm left feeling there's so much more I want to ask them. I often wonder, where are they now? So that's what I do here. I go back and I dig a little deeper. This is Insightful.
Police have staged the state's biggest ever raid targeting Sydney's alleged drug kings.
31 people have been arrested, among them well-known names.
This operation was so big, as I said, we didn't take off a tentacle here, we took out the octopus.
13 months planning, 6 drug syndicates busted, a bad day for organised crime.
In this episode, I catch up with Wayne Cleveland. He was a professional big wave surfer who once chased huge swells around the world, but then he decided to become involved in a different kind of risky pursuit, drug trafficking, smuggling cocaine.
I was importing drugs into Australia. I did this quite a few times a year for a long, long time. It was second nature for me.
Wayne's world came crashing down in 2009 when he was arrested in an Australian Federal Police sting. He was sentenced to 16 years in jail and served 10.
I took those risks, but I didn't realise the consequences on what kids and what they suffered and what they endured the 10 years that I was incarcerated.
I met Wayne on an episode about risk and reward and was struck by his honesty. He's one of those people who really owns his stuff. So to start our chat, we met up one windy afternoon at a place that was his home for many years.
Standing outside the Long Bay Correctional Centre, what's it like sort of coming home to a place that was, what, home for 4.5 years?
Well, I try and block that out. I try and numb that out, you know what I mean? Because yeah. Of the fact, like, I don't need to look over and reminisce on anything good.
Does it seem like a sort of another life?
Well, it does. It was just a bad time, bad period in my life that I made wrong decisions.
Not wanting to dwell on the memories of Long Bay for you too much, but I just can't help looking at this big metal gate. I just struggle to get my head around the fact that just beyond that gate are people living there for years at a time. It just feels so strange that it's literally metres away.
There's like 20 wings in there. There's 90 to 100 plus in every wing. So how much is that? What, 2,000 people? Mm. So you're looking at 2,000 people, which are pretty much at this time getting locked in, like right now. Like muster would be going on, they'd be calling muster, they could be getting locked in. I've been there. I know exactly what's installed, you know what I mean?
When you got out of jail, you ended up living across the road.
Literally.
How did that come about?
My partner, she had a house, like literally across the road. She'd been living there for 7 years already. So I literally moved in with her when I got out. So when I walked out every day, I was walking out looking at the front of Long Bay. Instead of looking out at the houses, I was looking in. Literally, you can actually see the house where I was living. It's just there, across the road.
That is bizarre. Yeah. And Long Bay's not far from your old stomping ground, which is Maroubra in southern Sydney. How would you describe Maroubra?
It was a very surf-orientated community. It was a rough area when we grew up. It was a very rough area. It was a no-nonsense area. A lot of hardcore people came through there and were born and bred there. So it was kind of, that was our upbringing. Now it's a lot different.
Had you ever thought of leaving this area and living somewhere else?
This is my home. It's in my blood. I love it.
Wayne, you're a self-confessed thrill-seeker and risk-taker. What does that feel like in your body when you're taking a risk, like surfing a huge wave?
For some reason, as a little kid, I've always been an adrenaline junkie. If you can bottle that feeling, I'd probably be a billionaire right now.
Right.
That's just how I feel inside when I take those certain risks. These days, it's all about jumping out of planes or surfing big waves, doing these type of things. That's my thrill these days.
Right.
Less risky. It's a bit risky, don't get me wrong. I had two near drownings last year surfing, so still very dangerous, but not the stuff that's going to put you inside jail.
What about the size of a wave or the reputation of a surf break? Does that ever make you decide not to surf it? Do you ever go, nah, you know what, not going to go there?
Not yet. I'm not at that age yet. I'm 53 and I still have that kid mentality. So when people ask how old I am, I always go physically or mentally. I say that because my mental, I think my eldest daughter is probably more mature than what I am.
So what would your mental age be?
Somewhere between 17 and 19, I think. Honestly, I've just got a full kid brain. Full kid brain.
How did you, a pro wave surfer, come to be part of a drug smuggling network?
I just got given an opportunity.
So someone came up to you?
Well, they asked me to do something for them and I was all for it. So I didn't even hesitate. See, I've always classified it like this. This is how I've put it. It's like me paddling for a wave at Pipeline, you know, which is quite a dangerous play. I'm paddling, I'm going, 110% I'm going. So I believe if you hesitate there, you're going to get injured. And that's how I've kind of looked at life. I just go. I'm going. So the opportunity came up. I jumped on it. Don't get me wrong, but the area we grew up in was full of this activity also.
Yes.
So it wasn't like I was naive and going, oh, yeah, like, you know, like I'd seen plenty of it around our area. So it wasn't nothing new for me.
What was it like when you agreed to traffic cocaine?
I treated it like a job. It was like it was a straight-out job. I was partying back then, but when I'd done my runs, I never, ever had a line of cocaine before. I went to the airport and went out there all like bug-eyed and nervous and things like that. Mate, I treated it like a business. When I got home, don't get me wrong, and the sales were done, I had a good party. But in saying that, everything was like a business. I calculated every penny, what was spent, how much do I need for this, what do I do here? Like everything, it was a proper business. And like, I was kind of a bit cunning in a way. Like, I don't even have hair on the side of my face. I'm kind of a hairless person. So I always look really younger for my age. So I played on that. Like, I'd come in like a little blonde-headed surfy kid. Hey, how are you? Oh, how are you? Did you enjoy your trip? Yeah, fantastic. Little did I know, like, I got 2.5 kilos strapped to me.
How did you actually conceal the drugs?
Okay, so what we would do is I'd get it, I'd roll it out like a pizza dough. I would put it in vacuum sealed bags. We would vacuum seal it. I would squash it against my body. I would wrap it around my body, wrap around my legs, around my body, under my arms. A good fit, honestly, a good fit is 2 kilos to 2.5 kilos. Because I'm a kind of leaner person, I could get away with that. A bigger person might not. It all depends how baggy your clothes were. And you can't go in looking too baggy, walking through the airport, middle of summer, when you've got jeans and jackets and, you know, hoods, and it doesn't really work. So the less clothes you have, the better off you are, because it doesn't look like you're concealing anything.
So you would have maybe just a T-shirt or a shirt, but it would look like you just had a bit more body mass.
Okay, so we call it the tidy whitey. So I'd have a white singlet on, I would wrap it around that, and I'd have tights on, like bike tights, but shorts over the top, and just wrap it like super tight. And then I had like surf shorts, it's a bit loose. And then I put another white singlet on, and then I'd put a T-shirt or a long sleeve shirt. So I would smother it in between the two singlets.
How did you figure that outfit out? Were you given advice? This is the best way to do it. Did you kind of experiment with things in your house?
Okay, so the first time I ever did it, I only just wrapped it straight to my body with silver duct tape. That's the first time I ever did. So ripping it off, it was like ripping skin off. I was like, oh my God. It was just ripping. It was ripping skin off, mate. I had those marks on me, I think, maybe a month. So I just went, I can't do that all the time because you're just like, you're ripping skin, like literally. So then I come up with the tidy whiting. That's how we always used to do it.
Was there ever any stage that you thought twice about what you were doing?
No. My theory was, and it's stupid, if it ain't broken, don't fix it. Like, why am I going to fix something that's not broken? It worked for me. I was just kind of a stoner, surfer, just floating through life going, oh, yeah, in my little bubble. And just going, oh, let's do this again, yeah. But when I did it properly. I wasn't, you know, all laxy-daisy about it. I knew the consequences. I did know that, obviously. But it worked for me, and I had a good system going for a very long time.
I imagine the money was pretty good. Can you say how much you got per job?
Okay. In the end, when I got busted, between the Crimes Commission and everything, they took $5.5 million off me. So money was pretty good.
Was it sitting in a bank account?
Oh, no. That was including houses, cash that was stashed. And, like, even when they raided me at the house, mate, I think I had 50,000 Aussie, 25,000 US, and, like, all these sums. So that was, like, 100,000+ there. Then there was other money. The houses, they took the houses. They sold the houses. Money got distributed. Like, it was, yeah. So in the end, I lost about $5.5 million.
Can you tell me about the day that you were arrested? What do you remember about that day?
The most vivid thing that I remember is my little kids' faces.
Really?
Like, I'll never forget that.
Police come to your door?
Oh, yeah. So altogether, I think there was like 20 of them that came running down. They came running in, bang, bang on the door. My kids were just like, they're just so tiny. I just remember their little faces. They were just so confused. You got a picture, their dad is there one moment, their dad's gone, boom.
What time of day was it? Were you all in the house at the kitchen?
Like, it was like 7 o'clock in the morning. I was making juice for the kids. I was making juices, fresh juices. So they were all sitting in front of me out of the corner of my eye because it was all glass and I have like a little hill. So they come down the hill and I looked and went, holy shit. And I knew who it was. And the bang, bang, bang. I opened the door. They come running in and just the kids' faces. That's I still remember their faces. It's like yesterday. It's like exactly like yesterday.
So how old were they at the time?
Okay, so my youngest one was 4. Middle one, 6, and then 7. And then I have a stepson too. He was 10. So when I was arrested, it was a matter of 10 minutes before I walked out the house. My partner at the time, her sister was already standing at the front. They had rung her. They said, listen, you know, you need to come over and help your sister. Then obviously the neighbours came out and the kids went next door. And then when I jumped in the car, the fed goes, yeah, we have to ring, you know, because we knew your partner at the time, you know, she would have needed help with the kids and stuff like that.
I just had this image in my mind come up of these juices left on the kitchen counter.
Yep. It changed our life. It changed our life, like dramatically. Like I coughed at sweat. I'm a big boy. I did what I did. Right, so I knew the consequences, but did my little kids know the consequences of what I was doing? No, they didn't. I went to jail. Mate, I rock in there. I know 25% of the people. Like, you know, because it was my environment at the time. The sweepers were all Maroubra boys.
Who are the sweepers? What's sweepers? Okay,
so a sweeper is the guy that they let out super early in the morning and they get locked in late at night. They do is they sweep the wings, they mop the floors, they give you your cereal, your milk. Yeah, so if you need anything, can I help you? Like, hey, what's going on, mate? You all right? Mate, you need an extra dish? You okay? So they're the guys that are out. They're out early and they get locked in later.
So you already knew people.
I was lucky because jail is a eat or be eaten mentality. You know, people will pick on the vulnerable straight up. If you're a weak and you're showing a little bit, you know, vulnerability, you'll get eaten alive. But then I've seen guys come in too. They get their books. They sit in the corner with them. There's another 6 or 8 guys. All they do is sit there reading books. And then you've got the guys that play chess. And, you know, they sit over there and play chess. But they're predators, mate. They find the weak ones.
What was a typical day like in jail?
So really, for me, I get up, I always have a water. I've got to go to the toilet straight away. That's just how I've always functioned, no matter where I go. I have a coffee. I won't eat anything because as soon as those doors open, we're in the yard, we're training. Like the CrossFit circuits. So sometimes these circles would go for an hour and a half to 2 hours. Then we would stop, we would rest, kick back, and we would walk. We would walk, have a chat. Cut through the middle, and there's all the boys who are the sweepers. They're inside, they're handing out sandwiches, like maybe some muesli with yogurt, with some fruit. Or on the weekends, it was, every Sunday it was like hot pies. Saturdays were like sausage rolls and these like hot dog things, you know, it's all heartburn material. Everything else is, honestly, it's just rubbish. It's terrible, the food.
Did you learn anything different about yourself in jail?
I knew I could withstand a lot. That's one thing. I've always been very resilient. And you got a lot of time to think. So I was lucky because a lot of the time I was in a one out. So I'm there by myself. So I've always been pretty happy with my own company. Like I've traveled the world by myself and bumped into people everywhere. I've always done it. Like it's just easier for one person to fit in anywhere. So I've always been quite happy with my own company. But in there, you know, like, you know, you do some soul searching. You know what I did was? I'd write letters to people and just say sorry to them for the stupidest things that I'd done. And they're like, mate, like, really not? And then I'd come for a visit or I'd speak to them. They'd go, mate, are you serious? Mate, that was 20 years ago. I go, yeah, I just felt bad. I did that. Like, I terrorized someone for some reason or whatever it may be. And I went around. You know what someone said to me? They said, you know what you got to do is you got to learn to forgive yourself. Everyone around you has forgiven you. He goes, you've got to learn to forgive yourself.
You were such a lover of surfing. Did you miss that when you were in jail? What was it like not to be able to be in the water?
I'm very accepting of things. When I got in trouble, there was no surfing. There's no sleeping with your partner at the time. You can't sit there and stew on those things, mate. Those things will eat you up. Straight up, they will eat you up. There was no point in me sitting there stewing on it, making my time longer. But I will say this. I got to Cessnock. I got my C2 with a 6.2. So that means I can work around the jail. A pump blew in this massive, big man-made lake they made up in Cessnock, a huge thing. So we had to get on this little boat, go out. And the officer jumped on board and had like these goggles with the light on. It kind of blew and they were putting it together. I couldn't help myself. I jumped in the water.
Oh, wow.
I didn't get in trouble enough. I jumped in the water and they said, swim the shore, Cleveland, don't worry about it. I swam the shore. Honestly, do you know, my body soaked up so much. It was fresh water, so much of that water. Like, it just, like, my body was, I didn't realize. Like, I'm having a shower, but it's not the same. When you're immersed in the water, I'm all under, I'm swimming underneath, and I was going, how good is this? Mm. Like, that's when it came back to me, just going, mate, imagine being in the surf.
What was it like the day you left prison? Was that freedom just a sort of shock? Was it real?
When I walked out, I was walking out and my daughter come running down to me. As she come running down, that's when it kind of hit. I really got overwhelmed. My eyes welled up, had tears coming down my face, and it'd been a long time coming. It'd been 10 years on the day. I was very appreciative, very overwhelmed. Jumped in the car with my dad and we drove straight down to the beach. And I was just going, and I knew I was free.
Do you ever wonder, at 53 now, what your life would be like had 10 years of that not been spent in jail?
That was my life at the time. Obviously, I would like things to be different, but they're not, they weren't. So I can't just sit there and go, mate, it is what it is. That's the life I chose. I chose that life. No one chose that for me. No one chose it. No one twisted my arm and told me to do this and to do that. Nobody. I knew what I was doing. The whole time I was doing it, I got busted. I never pointed my finger, oh, yeah. Mate, copped it on the chin, done my 10. I'm working now. My kids are back in my life, thank goodness. Beautiful partner now. I'm training like I was when I was in, like back in jail. I'm getting up in the morning. I make time for these things now. Like things, obviously they would have been a lot different, but it's like when you get stuck at a red light, right? That red light stopped you for a reason. Imagine 2 minutes down the road you had a head-on crash. Like, how do you know what could happen in that 10 years?
That's a really interesting way to look at it.
That was obviously meant to happen in my life. I just copped it on the chin.
What are you most proud of?
I'm proud that I've been clean this May for 15 years and I have three absolutely gorgeous girls. I have a beautiful partner. So I am proud of who I am now.
Wayne, it's been such a pleasure to see you again. I can't thank you enough for coming to chat.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Insightful, an 8-part series from SBS, recorded in Sydney, Australia, on the land of the Gadigal people. Insightful is produced by Felicity Davey, Cassandra Allen and Kate Harassi, and edited by Maddox Foster. If you enjoyed this episode, please stay tuned for more. Until next time, I'm Kumi Taguchi. Thanks so much for your company.